And welcome everyone to this WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is Data Power Application Optimization, How to Reduce Costs and Improve Efficiencies. Today's presenter is Timothy Smith. Tim joined the Data Power organization in 2008 to help design and create the application optimization feature. Shortly thereafter, Tim became the application optimization architect. His Data Power responsibilities have included lead programmer roles, leading lab advocate roles, and Data Power design architecture roles. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Tim. Tim, you may begin.
Thank you, David. Appreciate the kind words. Let's go ahead and get started. I'll go through the agenda and then get into the details shortly. Next chart, please, Dave. So chart two, I wanted to spend a little bit more time on the agenda. We have these charts sprinkled throughout the presentation, but I'll just walk through it here, and then we'll just use it to separate different sections from each other. So I'll start off with a little bit of Data Power background. I do want to level set everybody, and I also want to set the framework for why we did application optimization and how it fits in. And then the next section, I will talk specifically about the decisions to go into application optimization, what our goals are, and how we plan to achieve those. And then the next couple of sections, the network optimization and the application intelligence sections, are actually details on the components inside the application optimization feature. Then we're going to step back for a little bit and talk about content distribution, and this will focus on not just the enterprise, but also the internet, flows across the internet, and how you can take advantage of some offerings that IBM has to accelerate that. And then we'll go back and finish up talking a little bit about the cloud and some features that IBM has added to Data Power to help protect in a cloud environment. Next chart, please, David. So chart three is really the roadmap of Data Power, or at least the history of Data Power, started in 2000. And I think what you see is that Data Power initially started with a very aggressive delivery of functionality, hardware, and software. And we've tried to keep that throughout the history of Data Power. Just a couple of key points here. The XI50 really took Data Power to the next level as far as the ability to integrate with a variety of platforms. So the integration appliance, as it's called, really was the first instance of where Data Power could act as an ESB. Another important landmark is in 2009. That's when we introduced the AO feature. And again, I'll go into more detail on that. Let's go on to chart four, Dave. So why an appliance? And those of you that have seen a lot on Data Power have seen charts similar to this. First of all, it's purpose-built hardware. It's directly built with security in mind. We've passed a number of security qualifications. But we've also paid a great deal of attention to hardware and performance. So what you'll find is that the Data Power firmware takes a great deal of advantage of the architecture of the hardware. So we do have supplemental hardware features that can be purchased, but also just the core CPU complex, Data Power's firmware takes all of that into account. But then functionality is also perhaps one of the strongest suits of Data Power. So within this box, you're able to do service level management or flow control, dynamic routing and load distribution, / deep packet routing, security, authorization, authentication, policy enforcement, and the ability to transform, manipulate messages, aggregate messages, and so on, give you a toolkit to address a huge number of networking applications. And then the bottom line is that we have tried to focus on continually improving our user interface. So when you're configuring these flows, you essentially establish a rule. It gives you a flow, and then you pick and choose actions that you add to that flow to manipulate or process the request as it's being passed through. So a large toolbox, a lot of things can be addressed with the base data power. Next chart, please. Application optimization. Next chart, please, Dave. So chart six is where we start to get into why and how application optimization came to be. So back in 2008, Adolfo Rodriguez, who's Data Power's distinguished engineer, and Jerry Cuomo, an IBM fellow, got together with a host of other guys and did some analysis of both the DMZ and the ESB. They mapped out all the functions that were part of the ESB, and there were many of them, lots of different platforms playing lots of different roles. And the trend was actually to move processing out of the trusted domain more and more into the DMZ, moving those decisions up earlier in the processing of a request. And it makes good sense. So the applications running on the application servers, they're not good at security. They're not good at XML parsing. They're not good at encrypting and decrypting and those types of things. They're good at their business logic and what they're trying to, what features they're trying to provide. So we've seen this movement of functionality into the DMZ. And that's really made the DMZ a very complicated place to be. And so Data Power has taken a look at this, and Data Power has a large collection of these features. Next chart, please, Dave. So chart 7 really describes where we're trying to go with application optimization, is that we want to capture all of those features that were listed on the prior chart, either in the base Data Power or within the application optimization feature. So the things like load balancing, front side, back side, a number of security features are included in this application optimization work. Now, it's really a philosophy in addition to a licensed feature offering. So we may do some things under the application optimization umbrella and then decide that it should go into the base Data Power platform, and I'll make mention of a couple of those going forward. But that's the bottom line, is that we want to consolidate as many functions as possible into the single platform, and I'll go through what those functions are and how they play. Next chart, please, Dave. So if we're successful in doing that, then the benefits of application optimization are terrific. So the total cost of ownership is dramatically reduced. There clearly is the buying fewer boxes that clearly saves a lot of money. But fewer boxes also means there are fewer boxes to keep current, fewer boxes to manage, fewer boxes to configure. Fewer boxes to have to go down the learning curve on software and hardware packages and make sure they're compatible with each other. So there's a significant cost advantage. But there's also a significant network infrastructure advantage. So the more appliances you have or more functions that you have in separate boxes in the DMZ, and the more complex that DMZ becomes. And we've heard this from a number of customers, that they're really looking to simplify their environment. So that's another positive aspect of this. And then if you have fewer boxes, you're going to see some performance benefits. So there are fewer networking hops, fewer protocol stacks to go up and down, and together that results in lower latency and higher throughputs. And then security, the bottom line is that security is here to stay, and security needs to be on all aspects of boxes. So having a secure device play the majority of these roles is of great benefit. Next chart, please, Dave. Chart 9 just lists off a little bit of the application option feature. So it is a licensed feature. It costs an additional amount on top of an XI50, XI52. There are only certain platforms that the AO feature can run on, the XS40, XG45, XI50, XI52, and XI50B. Actually, the XE82 has the AO feature standard as an option, or as a standard option. Next chart, please. Next, we'll chat about networking optimization and self-balancing. Next chart, please. So chart 11 talks a little bit about self-balancing. So if you have a data power appliance and you've spent all your time creating these services and you have it working exactly as you want, well, if you need to increase the capacity, then you have to add a second data power appliance. And once you do that, then you have to have something that shares the IP load or distributes the IP load in front of those data power appliances. And even if it's not a capacity issue, you would probably want multiples for high availability. So the typical solution has been to put an IP sprayer in front of data power appliances. And what self-balancing is trying to do is to eliminate the need for that extra tier of IP-based load balancers. So we call this front-side load balancing. And with self-balancing, it works like this. One of the appliances in a tier of appliances is essentially the primary, and it owns the virtual IP address. All of the requests come in to that single primary platform, and it makes the decision on should this request be routed to one of the secondaries or should it be handled by itself. So it's going to be the distribution point. And then it keeps track of the connection. So if a request comes in and he routes it to one of the secondary data power appliances, then he'll keep track of that connection so that every subsequent request that's in that connection gets routed over to that same data power appliance. Now, all of the appliances themselves return the request directly back to the source. So there's a routing hop on the ingress side and directly back on the egress side. So self-balancing does take a little bit of CPU utilization, but it's pretty small, and it's we think it's a good value proposition. One of the problems that we ran into when we first came out with self-balancing was that when the primary goes down, the owner of the virtual IP address, then one of the secondaries would take over that ownership. But the secondary had to learn the connection table from scratch. So that caused all of the connections that were going to this tier of data power appliances to be lost at that moment in time until they could be reestablished. So with the 4.02 release, we added this active-active failover. Now, each of the appliances keeps a hot table of the connections that are in progress so that if the primary goes down, then one of the secondaries can take over, and the connections to the other data power appliances that are still alive are kept intact. So that's self-balancing. Let's go on to the next chart. Here's a little bit on how to configure self-balancing. So it uses the standby control configuration. Standby control is how we configure the passing of virtual IP addresses. So essentially you have a group number, all of the appliances that are using this self-balancing would have that same group number and same virtual IP address, which is the advertised IP address. Then there's a preempt mode and a priority if you want one of the data power appliances to always be the primary, so you know which one is acting as primary. You would set this and set the priority to higher than the other data power appliances. When this appliance goes down, it would, of course, be replaced by a secondary, but when it comes back up, it would negotiate and take back over the virtual IP address. Then I'm just going to skip to the bottom question. So to turn on self-balancing, you simply need to enable the self-balancing mode. And that's all the configuration that's required. It does assume that you have similarly configured data power appliances so that they have the same set of named services and domains and so on, so that it can look to see how to distribute the incoming load. On to the next chart, Dave. Quiet support. So this is on chart 13. Quiet support was added in the 3.8.1 release. So this is about stopping traffic in a graceful way. What we're trying to do is when you wish to quiesce some aspect of the box, it allows transactions that are in progress to complete the transaction, but it prevents new transactions from taking place. So it starts blocking. If a transaction takes an excessive amount of time, then it will time out and bring down that transaction or connection. And then once that's completed, the quiesce state is communicated back. Now, a special thing that this dovetails in with the self-balancing is that there are hooks so that self-balancing can see if one of the data power appliances is getting one of its services quiesced, for example, then the primary will see that and understand it and will stop routing traffic to that data power appliance for that service. Next chart, please, Dave. Okay, a little bit more on quiescing. So some use cases of where you might use it, firmware upgrades, changing configurations, and troubleshooting are some areas. And the granularity of quiescing is that you can quiesce a front-side protocol handler, you can quiesce service objects, you can quiesce the whole domain and all objects within that domain, or you can quiesce the entire appliance. Next chart, please, Dave. Next, we'll get into application intelligence. Next chart, please, Dave. So chart 16 talks about intelligent load distribution. So we just got done talking about self-balancing and front-side load balancing. Intelligent load distribution is the backside. So this is back-end load balancing to a collection of servers on the back end. So if it's a WebSphere collection, then the notion is a cluster of servers. These servers are all assumed to be running the same application. Data Power originally had a number of load balancing capabilities, and these were kind of a best-kept secret. So what intelligent load distribution has done is to take advantage of those load balancing characteristics and augment it and make it a little bit stronger. I'll go through some of those aspects with you. The first one is dynamic configuration. So with intelligent load distribution, we're able to go back and learn the topology on the back end. That is, we're able to learn what servers and ports are configured in a given cluster. So Data Power will actually go back, retrieve that information, and then populate its internal load balancer groups so that it automatically learns and starts routing traffic to those servers. So if you add a new server to your cluster, Data Power will pick that up and add it dynamically into the load balancer group. And likewise, if you remove a server, then Data Power would disable that server in the load balancer group and not forward any traffic to it. How does that work? So we actually have a servlet that was developed for WebSphere application servers. It only runs on WAS. And that servlet is able to tap into on-demand configuration within the WebSphere cell. So So it can see what servers are enabled and up and running. It can also see some application information, and I'll get into that in the next section. The information that's passed back, as I mentioned, is the collection of servers, but it also has weights associated with those servers. So if we're using a weighted load balancing algorithm, then the weights that are passed back will be added into that algorithm as well. And then the weighting infrastructure, it essentially provides a percentage overlay of that load balancer group. So if you have a server with twice as much weight as another server, then it's expected that that server would receive roughly twice as much traffic as the first server. So weight information is also learned, and also session affinity information is learned. So when we have a WebSphere backend, there's virtually nothing that you need to do to enable session affinity through a data power appliance. I'll go into more detail on the session affinity support, and I'll also go into a little bit more detail on a new load balancing algorithm that's part of this intelligent load distribution package. Next chart, please, Dave. So chart 17 talks about static versus dynamic configuration. So when I talked about us sending periodic requests to this servlet that we've installed on the back end, it's retrieving dynamic configuration information that's going to be used on the fly. So I wanted to take you through just a little bit of the distinction between the two. You can configure these things directly, so you can configure them statically. Anytime you configure through the web GUI or the CLI interface or through SOMA or the XML interface, you're doing a static type of configuration. There, the information is persisted. Anytime you reboot the box, it will come up with the static configuration. And that applies to the load balancer group. So if you create a member in a load balancer group, that member will be in that load balancer group as soon as you power up. Now, dynamic configuration is runtime only. And what happens is that we go out to this ODC Info servlet, we retrieve the information, and once we get a good refresh of information, then we overlay the whole load balancer group. So if a member was already present in that load balancer group by the static configuration, then we'll just update it. So for example, if the weight has changed, then we'll change the weight on that load balancer member. If a server was statically configured and it's not in the group, then we disable that member. And likewise, if there are new members that were not part of that static configuration, then we'll add those dynamically. Now, you won't see it as part of the configuration panels. What you will see is when you're looking at the status provider, the newly learned members will show up in that status provider. Next chart, please, Dave. So chart 18 shows a little bit about the usability model. What this is to try to give you a few pointers on when you're setting up an intelligent load distribution environment. The first piece of advice is that you should always create a static implementation to begin with, just to make sure that the flows are working properly, that your DNS is resolving back-end servers properly, and so on. That will save a lot of headaches if you're trying to automate it. So first run it when it's statically configured, and then change the configuration to do it automatically. The first step in that would be to install this servlet. The servlet's called the ODC Info Servlet. There are a number of scripts that come with the Data Power package to help you install it, uninstall it, and verify that it's up and working properly. You can also just take a simple browser and enter in this URL where the ODC Info Servlet is supposed to be installed on the Deployment Manager. So this URL has the deployment manager host name and port where that ODC servlet is installed, with some other parameters in the URL, and a query parameter on the end that says C equals cluster name. So that's telling the ODC info application which cluster you want to retrieve this information from. And if you look at the result page, it returns back a fairly simple XML file. We have documented this XML file. So if you have a non-WebSphere backend and you wish to write your own application, you can take advantage of some of these intelligent load distribution features. Let me just walk through a little bit of the characteristics of that file or of that response. So you'll see that this is a request for the Dynatest cluster. That's the cluster name. It's sending back that we want to run in passive session affinity mode, and here are the session IDs that will be used for session affinity. And then it also has a list of servers, and so here are the server names and ports. An ID, this ID is used for session affinity resolution, and a weight associated with that server. Now there are two sections, one is HTTP and one is HTTPS. Both of those sections are returned back by default. And you will, in your configuration, specify which collection, whether you're going to send to the HTTP ports or the HTTPS ports for that given load balancer. Next chart, please, Dave. So chart 19 is how you would configure it inside the data power box. The first step is configuring the connection information so that we can connect to that ODC info servlet on the back end. And so that's specifying the deployment manager host name and port. It gives us the endpoints. If you want to secure the connection, then you'll need to configure an SSL proxy profile. It will use those parameters when establishing the connection for retrieving the information. And you also specify a polling interval. How frequently does data power go out to this servlet and retrieve information? If data power retrieves the information and sees that it's the same information as it's already using, it does nothing with it. If it sees that there's a change, then it goes in and updates the load balancer accordingly. Next chart, please, Dave. So chart 20, the WebSphere cell object that we just looked at is really a connector to the back-end servlet. The load balancer object itself has to be informed which connector to retrieve the information from. So you can see that in this load balancer group, there are a few questions. There's a text that says AO questions. Those only appear if you have the AO feature installed. The top one of those questions is retrieve workload management information. So this tells the load balancer group that he's going to be using dynamic configuration as opposed to just static configuration. Then the next question is to select what type of workload information to retrieve. And we only have one type so far, which is called WebSphere Cell. Once you select that, then these other questions show up for the WebSphere cell. The WebSphere cell object that we talked about in the previous chart will be part of a drop-down list. You just select the one that you want to attach to. You must specify the workload manager group name for the WebSphere cell. This is a cluster name. It must be exactly the same name, it's case sensitive. And then I described earlier that the protocol selection, either HTTP or HTTPS, tells the load balancer group which of those collection of servers to use. Should it use the secured servers or the non-secured servers? Next chart, please, Dave. So chart 21 is a status provider. It shows a list of servers and what load balancer group those servers are in. It lists the host name, the port, the operational state, the weight, and whether it's administratively enabled or disabled. Next chart, please, Dave. Okay, let me comment a little bit about one of the load balancing algorithms that we added in the AO feature. It's called weighted lease connections. And we talked a little bit earlier about weighting in the load balancer group. The weighting provides a percentage infrastructure of how much traffic is targeted towards that server. Leased connections has another preference, so it shows a preference to those servers that have fewer connections up and in use to that back-end server. So if you have a server that's responding quickly, then those connections will be freed up quickly and be available. If you have a server that's taking a long time to respond, then it will have connections accumulating and connections that are in use for longer periods of time. And so the preference is to shift traffic over to those with fewer connections. And this implicit back pressure that's exerted by the connections staying up or being serviced quickly causes us to reroute traffic fairly quickly. So a fairly common occurrence of problems with back-end servers is that you'll have a server that is sick but not dead. So the appliance is able to set up a connection to it, perhaps to send the request, but it never gets a response back. And so in that kind of situation with some simpler load balancer algorithms, we would probably just continue to try to use that server. But with this back pressure, it allows us to shift traffic over to the good servers and the ones that are slower or hung do not receive very much traffic at all. Next chart, please. Okay, the third aspect of ILD was the session affinity support. And prior to the AO feature, session affinity was not available to DataPower customers. And we saw in forum requests, people had tried to implement session affinity in various ways using style sheets and global variables. And it proved to be a nightmare of a challenge. So we've added the support natively. Let me talk a little bit about what session affinity is. It's a cookie-based technology. So certain applications wish to use session information to track a user, perhaps to keep track of shopping carts or other things about that user. And they do this through session information. And what happens is that when an application needs session affinity, it makes a request typically to the container. And the container sends out a set cookie with a session ID in it. And that session ID contains a couple of pieces of information, certainly the session ID name, which is typically JSession ID. But then it also contains what session this client belongs to. And it may also contain routing information. Well, with the WebSphere session ID, it does contain the routing information, and we'll use that to route the request to the right server. So when session affinity is requested, each request from that client will go to the same server. So DataPower's role in all of this is as the request passes through DataPower, it will look at the session information. It will see if it can resolve that to a server on the back end. If there's no information or it can't resolve it, then it will drop back and perform a load balancing of that request to the back end. Next chart, please, Dave. So passive session affinity, there are actually three types of session affinity that we support. Passive session affinity only works with WAS application servers. It's because we have to know and understand the format of the session ID. It's the least aggressive. Data Power really doesn't do anything in the flow itself. It only monitors the request packets and response packets, or actually the request packet, to see if there is a session ID. And like we said, if there is, then it will try to use that to route the request. And if it's not present, it just load balances the request. But that's the only thing that Data Power participates in when it's running with passive session affinity. Next chart, please. Chart 25 is active conditional session affinity. So this is a little bit more aggressive. Data Power actually participates in appending a set cookie request or a set cookie header to the response packet. So with active conditional, this works for either WAS backends or for non-WAS backends. What we're doing is we're monitoring the backend to see if it's putting a set cookie into the response. And if it is, then it matches the cookie that we're monitoring, then we know that server is trying to establish session affinity. And so we add our own set cookie behind it so that it has a Data Power specific cookie involved. And then on each subsequent request, both of those cookies will be in the request. Data Power will look at its own cookie, understand it, and route the request back to the server. So the server doesn't really know any difference. He just knows he asked for session affinity and that it's working properly. Next chart, please. So chart 26 is the most aggressive form of session affinity. It's called active session affinity. This one, Data Power initially load balances the first request, but on the response, it automatically does a set cookie for Data Power's session ID. And then again, when the client returns back to that server, it will include that cookie in the request, and Data Power will know how to route it. So this automatically forces session affinity to the back end. Again, it's a little more aggressive. There are some environments where that comes into play. Next chart, please, Dave. So chart 27 is how to configure it. And again, if you do not have AO installed on your Data Power appliance, you would not see this session affinity tab in the load balancer group configuration. I'll just run through quickly the configuration options. So the enable is an on-off switch for session affinity. It defaults to enabled. And again, if you have a WebSphere backend, it will automatically be configured for passive session affinity. You won't need to configure anything. But if you have a non-WebSphere backend, then you'll need to click the button that says Override WebSphere Cell Session Affinity. That will make a couple of questions appear. One is the mode, and you can select either active conditional or active. And you can also specify the monitored cookies if you're configuring for active conditional. And we'll, again, start monitoring those cookies. If we see one, then we'll assume that session affinity was requested for that flow and start using our own session affinity there. When we do add our own set cookie, those are the insertion cookie parameters, so you can specify what the name is of that session ID header. Also, you can specify the path and the insertion domain. Next chart, please, Dave. Okay, now we're going to get into a little bit higher up the stack. So most of what we were talking there was with regard to routing just to specific back-end servers within a cluster. And the assumption was that all the applications running on those servers was the same. With application addition routing, we no longer assume that. So we actually extend that XML document that we saw a while back to include not only the servers, but it includes the applications that are running on those servers and the states of those applications. And where does this come into play? Well, it comes into play when you're doing application edition changes. So only on WebSphere Virtual Enterprise, there's this ability for you to dynamically roll out a new version or a new edition of an application. And when that's happening, the server is being brought down, loaded up with a new application, and brought back online. WebSphere is doing that on the backside. It's also communicating with DataPower so that we know which editions to route requests to and whether or not we can only route session affinity requests, whether we have to completely stop sending requests and what have you. So there's a lot of state change information, and DataPower participates in that with the WebSphere backend. Next chart, please, Dave. To enable application edition routing, you simply set it on in the load balancer group. Next chart, please, Dave. Okay, so back to the agenda. What we just covered was self-balancing and intelligent load distribution. Those are the two largest components within the AO feature. I'm going to step out outside the AO feature for a little bit and talk about content distribution and an offering that we have called the WebSphere Application Accelerator for Public Networks. This is a joint offering between IBM and Akamai, and I'll go into a little bit about how they play. Next chart, please. So chart 31 is a little bit on what Akamai is. Akamai has actually put together an overlay of the Internet with their own servers sending and receiving information. It still uses the underlying Internet, but it optimizes. And it optimizes in several ways. So one of which is that it figures out an optimal route. So if there are roadblocks, bottlenecks in the Internet flow, Akamai will figure out the best way to get around that. So it's optimized the flows, but it's also invested a lot in caching technologies. So if you have a client that is requesting content, then it tries to cache that information as close to the client as possible so that when it does subsequent requests, that information is very close to the client. And then thirdly, they've done a lot of things with TCP optimizations. So once you get into this Akamai overlay, then really the request is from Akamai box to Akamai box. So they can do some special things with TCP that you couldn't do if you were working with different implementations. Next chart, please. So in the prior sections, we really talked mostly about optimizing the enterprise or the reverse proxy environment that DataPower was playing in. Here we're taking a look at the end-to-end picture. And so if you have, for example, a large geographical area where there's a lot of distance and there are potentially a lot of hops in that transaction, you'll see the delay grow dramatically. That's what this offering seeks to address. So in this example, it's actually from Sydney to Stockholm. The amount of time that we spend handling requests from the data center to the Internet is roughly a quarter of a second. And also the amount of time that those requests are passing from the client to the Internet is roughly a quarter of a second as well. And the flow across the Internet is the real bottleneck. So in this example, there are 31 round trips, each at about 340 milliseconds. So 10 seconds worth of time is taken by traversing the Internet. And the total response time is 10.5 seconds as far as the user is concerned. Next chart, please, Dave. So chart 33 is with the Akamai network. So they do a couple of things, and we talked about the caching, but they can also reduce the number of round trips that are involved. So in this second instance, where we have the WebSphere application accelerator for public networks, we see that the first mile and the last mile are the same, but the amount of time that's spent in the middle has been reduced, so that now there are only 9 round trips, and each round trip is under 300 milliseconds. So the total is a dramatic improvement in response time. So this is something that we wanted to do and take advantage of, partnering with Akamai. Let me go to the next chart, please, Dave. So chart 34 shows what the WebSphere application acceleration for public networks is. It gives you access to the Akamai network, but it also includes a toolkit that works within the Data Power appliance. That toolkit contains a set of security credentials. It contains a set of sample applications and configurations, as how to use and optimize transactions with the Akamai network, one of which is security. So let me just talk about that for a moment. With these credentials, you can configure Data Power to only accept requests from the Akamai network. This eliminates a large collection of attacks where the attacker is trying to attack the data center directly. It also contains a configuration so that Data Power can participate in the beacon protocol that Akamai uses to search through the Internet for an optimal path. And that way, Data Power will be included in that optimal path. So the result is better performance, more consistent performance, and better security overall. Next chart, please, Dave. Chart 35, we're going to talk next about security and the secure cloud connector. Next chart, please, Dave. So chart 36 is where we were quite a while ago. So everybody was happy. We had users out on the Internet. They would always come into the enterprise through a firewall and pass through a DMZ onto a back end. We had pretty much complete control of the security for each of those transactions. Likewise, enterprise users that accessed our own applications internally, we knew the security model there. And any sort of transactions to the database, we also knew the security model there. Next chart, please, Dave. But then a cloud showed up on the horizon, and with that cloud, there was a lot of promise. Cloud computing really has had an enormous impact so far. There are problems, but it clearly has some terrific advantages. So namely that you have this elastic capability to go out and expand your computing capability or reduce it on demand. But what that also means is that there is some difficulty with knowing what is secure and what is not. And a lot of people are spending a lot of time trying to figure out what's the best model for securing things. So you have users on the Internet. They may have secure connections or not. The application servers themselves may or may not be secure. Likewise, enterprise users that are going out, you need to address the security model there. And if those applications require databases, then you need to figure out what to do for the security there. Next chart, please, Dave. So on chart 38, Data Power has added to the AO feature this new function called the Secure Cloud Connector. Essentially, it's to leverage what we talked about in the very first couple of slides, where Data Power has built up this ability to do ESB types of operations. So that, coupled with this ability to create a connector that is secure to the cloud, gives us a way of securing those transactions. So in this particular chart, what you see is that we're returning to a similar model to what that original enterprise model was, where there's a firewall, a DMZ, Data Power starts participating. The traffic passes through Data Power, and then given that it's able to transform, manipulate, aggregate flows, Data Power can go out through this secure cloud connector to a back-end server and back, and perform those services. So it's really a seamless operation. The clients, either on the internet or in the enterprise, don't really know that the servers are out in the cloud. Next chart, please, Dave. So the secure cloud connector, from a Data Power perspective, is really just a tunnel interface. So what we're doing is we're establishing an SSH tunnel with the back-end server. It does have some requirements on that server, so it can't just generically work with a server in the cloud somewhere. You have to have some level of control, some input as to the way that server is managed, one of which it has to have open SSH running on it at the level 4.3P1 or higher. We only support IPv4 addressing. And once the secure tunnel is created, transactions can happen in either direction. Flows can happen in either direction. That's what we have on Secure Cloud Connector. Let me go to the next chart, please, Dave. The configuration of it is pretty straightforward. So let me just walk through the fields. The remote host and remote port is how we're connecting to the remote server. The SSH client profile is essentially the credentials and mapping of what that SSH tunnel will look like. Local and remote tunnel IPv4 addresses are respectively the Data Power local IP address and the remote server on the cloud address. A remote tunnel identifier, that's really just an internal mapping. If you leave it zero, then we'll specify our own identifier. Remote auto configuration, this tells us that when we set up that SSH tunnel, we can tell the application side that it's okay for him to also set up the tunnel and to add the IP routing to his routing tables. And last but not least, there's a liveness check. A periodic ping will be sent if you select on. That's it for the configuration of the Secure Cloud Connector. Next chart, please, Dave. So chart 41 is just a chart that I want to use to summarize the discussion. So Data Power itself has a wealth of capabilities that allow you to secure, simplify, accelerate, and govern your networking needs. The AO feature is designed to augment that feature list with specific functions that help you to reduce the box count in your DMZ or your ESB. That's all I have for today's session. If you want more information, you can go to the URL specified www.ibm.com/software/integration/data power. Next chart, please, Dave. Chart 42 has an additional set of links where you can download or rewatch this presentation, download more information, developer works, articles, and guidance, participate in the WebSphere user group, or look at tutorials and so on at the IBM Education Assistant. That's all I have. I'm going to hang on for a while. I think Dave is going to take you through a few questions, and then we'll open it up for questions after that.
Okay. Thank you, Tim, for a great presentation. And finally, don't forget to connect with us. You can be notified about upcoming webcasts related to the product and topics discussed today by subscribing to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange mailing list. Simply send an email to wsehelp@us.ibm.com with subject of WSTE subscribe to get a list of mailing lists and to subscribe. Also, if there is a topic that you would like to see scheduled or if you have any comments that would help us improve our future webcasts, please let us know at that same email address. You could also connect with us through our Facebook page and our Twitter account. Talk to us and let us know how we can make this program even better. We do welcome any ideas that you may have. Thanks again for your participation. At this time, Don, we would like to open the lines for questions.
And I'm showing no questions in the queue.
Thank you, Don. Tim, we do have a few questions in the group chat, and I'll try to address these, read them to you.
Okay.
You might want to take a look as well. The first one was, so intelligent load balancing only works with WAS application server?
The answer to that is no. So by default, most of the support is fairly automatic with the WAS application server. But you can still get lots of benefit out of ILD without a WAS backend. So let me just comment on the areas. First off, we have a couple of things. Data Power, we added some default hooks where you could write your own style sheet to actually modify the load balancer group. So if you wanted to roll your own application, you could do that type of stuff on your own. But further than that, I had mentioned that there's an XML document that's published, and as long as that XML document contains the servers and so on, we won't know that it's a WebSphere backend or what kind of backend it is. We will just plug in that information automatically. So you can either, you know, publish it as just a file, or you can have a servlet that uses a little bit of intelligence to create that XML document, but that is an alternative. Now, outside of that, you still can use Session Affinity if you wish, without a WebSphere application server and without going through this creation of the XML document. You can also use the weighted least connections load balancing algorithm. Next question, Don, Dave?
Then there's another question from Johan, and there's a big chain of emails between him and John Rasmussen, but it has to do with AO self-balancing. Can it be achieved over separate network ranges? You might want to take a look.
Unfortunately, I lost connectivity to the...
Oh, goodness. Okay.
Thing, so I don't see a history.
Well, the question is, can AO self-balancing be achieved over separate network ranges? For example, one appliance, and there's an IP address, and another one with a different IPS, and VIPA should be another IP, and fail over that last one. It's confusing to me. And then,
let me make a couple of comments there. So the intent of self-balancing is to have... all of the participants in self-balancing, that is, every appliance in the tier, on the same subnet. It is not a best practice to have them on different subnets. So I would answer in that way, and if there's more questions, ask them on the forum, and we can get back to them there.
Okay. And then there's another question, which I believe you probably addressed in the first one, which is how does intelligent load balancing work with non-WAS servers?
Uh-huh.
I believe you addressed that.
Yes, I did.
Okay. Let's see. I'm looking. Then there's another one. Does the smart load balancer work only with WebSphere, or can it work with WebLogic and other servers? And I believe you've answered that as well.
Yep.
Okay. And session affinity is supported for which app servers?
Uh-huh.
These are all related to...
Yeah, let me comment on that one.
Okay.
So again, if you want to use passive session affinity, that's where data power knows and understands all of the session cookies that a WAS backend produces, then you must have, obviously, a WAS backend. But the other modes of session affinity, the active conditional and the active session affinity, can operate with any backend application server.
Okay, thank you. Then another question, excuse me. The secure cloud connector assumes the cloud provider supports SSH connection. Why not just use SSL? Is this for something that doesn't go over HTTP?
That's a good question. I don't have the developer here with me who led up that individual piece, and so I don't know the specifics. I do know that it fit the data power model a little bit more cleanly. I don't know the benefits and the trade-offs between the two.
Okay, thank you. And then another question. All of the information covered in this presentation is regarding the new optional application intelligence module. In other words, to get this functionality, you have to purchase an additional module.
So the answer is not all of this is requires you to purchase it. So I talked about a couple of features, for example, quiescing, where that feature was developed by the AO team, but it doesn't require that you buy the AO feature to use it. Most of the other features in this presentation do require that you pay for the license. It's an additional license feature that goes on top of the data power appliance. It's field upgradable, so if you bought a bunch of XI50s or XI52s and you wish to add it later on, you can do so. But the one other feature that we talked about, the WebSphere Application Accelerator for Public Networks, now that is independent of AO and has to be purchased separately.
Okay, thank you. He's the same person is asking, how much, generally speaking, does the AO cost?
I do not have cost information.
Yeah, I suspect that's up, you know, it's between them and the field rep.
Yep.
Okay. Well, I don't see any more questions in the group chat at this time. So we will conclude the presentation. We do hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation and hope you'll join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Tim, for presenting.
Thank you, Dave.